21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. My shoes are worn out, I'm walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feeling as I'm heading for the light.
Well, thank you, Traveling Wilburys. We are headed for the light tonight, friends. Our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Cordner. Our engineer is Noah Dankner. And I'm the alleged Dr. Bob Hieronymus. There they go, the Traveling Wilburys, one of the greatest groups ever. Well, our subject tonight is the famous UFO abduction case of Travis Walton, celebrating its 40th anniversary this month. Well, we have reviewed the new documentary film called Travis that premiered in February at the 2015 International UFO Conference, UFO Congress Film Festival in Scottsdale, Arizona, where it swept the EBE Awards for the Best Long Documentary Film and the People's Choice Award. Travis is now, well, it's a 90-minute documentary. It's a film recounting of the now world-famous 1975 UFO abduction of Travis Walton and the impact it has had on his life over the intervening 40 years. Wow, that's longer than we've been on the air on 21st Century Radio. Now, on the lives of others who were also involved. Now, you can view the trailer at TravisWaltonTheMovie.com. That's TravisWaltonTheMovie.com. Jennifer W. Stein is a self-taught filmmaker who never went to film school. She is an entrepreneur who started making films in the 1990s. While running a nonprofit organization, raising her two children and running a special events business. Well, it looks like she's doing everything. She's an everything type of person. Since 1999, Jennifer has been making documentary films and has won numerous EBE Awards for her UFO-related film work. In 2012, Jennifer won two Open Minds International UFO Congress EBE Film Festival Awards for her co-production of The Disclosure Dialogues with Ron James. She again succeeded in winning two more EBEs at the 2015 Open Minds Film Festival for her film Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton, which she co-produced with Bob Terrio. I hope I pronounced Bob's last name correctly. Did I pronounce Bob's last name correctly?
Yes, you did.
I did. Did I win a prize? Did I win a prize?
Of course.
Okay, well, I just won two.
Another DVD.
Okay, thank you. I just also won $200,000 for that one, friends. See what happens when you listen to 21st Century Radio? Or at least what I think that happens. How did you find your way into filmmaking, Jennifer?
Well, I was always trying to do things economically, and I realized that I could do it myself rather than hiring somebody else to do stuff. And that's how I started making films. And then I realized that it was a powerful way to communicate story. Mm-hmm. And I just decided it was more what I wanted to do than run that next bar bat mitzvah or that next, you know, business conference or whatever I was being hired to do in my events business. And I liked the creativity that it provided me. And I knew it was long-range impact. What I was doing was more like performance art, sort of, mm-hmm. because I had to have an event ready by a certain date and time. And when I did film, I could... You know, shooting was always intense. That was like an event. But editing I could do till 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning in the comfort of my own studio. I didn't have to worry about people stealing equipment from me or arguing over, you know, labor laws or union people refusing to turn tables for me to get my wedding off the road because the wedding before ran over or something. Mm-hmm. So it just seemed like a better... a more powerful and more impactful endeavor for me to sink my teeth into. And I like a challenge. So I certainly bit off more than I thought I could chew in the Travis event.
Well, I'm so glad you did bite off more than you can chew because, you know, usually, especially in the arts, it takes a heck of a lot more to do something really good than most people think. You've just got to put your entire life into it. And obviously, you know how to do that with your life. And most other people, I think, would have been maybe a little bit too inhibited to go that way. I remember when I used to get frustrated with photographers not shooting things right and everything like that. That's when I became a photographer a while, but I hated it. And I know just how you feel that, boy, you are in control that way. You don't have to discuss, hey, I think this has to happen or that has to happen. You can move along much more rapidly that way for that freedom. But again, it costs you in energy and time, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Everything has a cost. There's no real free ride in life as much as we'd like to think there is.
Yeah, that's true. How did you come up with the name for your production company, On Wings? Am I pronouncing that correctly, Wings?
You are.
And well, I want another $100,000?
Well, I'll tell you, it stemmed from my maiden name, which was Wing. I am Norwegian, and in my father's ancestral background, so Wing, W-I-N-G-E, is my maiden name.
Oh.
And I wanted to, even though when I got married, I changed my name to Stein, which is means stone in German. I wanted to bring back in that energy from my own name that I, you know, my birth name. So I started email. When I needed to come up with an email account, I used the name Wing, and I put an O-N on the beginning and an S on the end because I needed that many number of letters for the first email account, and it kind of stuck.
Good.
And since I had been using On Wings for years, that's where I sort of came up with a name for the production company. I know it's kind of silly and simple, but, you know, like they say, don't sweat the small stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easy for me to remember, and it kind of brought in. I also was a student of Zachariah Sitchin's, and I studied, you know, the winged disc and the philosophy of Egypt.
Yeah.
That was related to that concept. Some people think it stretches into the UFO phenomenon.
It does.
I liked sort of the metaphysical and spiritual connection that it had.
Yeah, you got multiple levels there, don't you?
Yeah, it was a good, I could do some good drawings with it. I could have a good business card
mm-hmm.
with a winged disc on it. So that's where On Wings Productions sort of came together.
Well, tell us how the film idea with Travis got started.
Well, it's kind of funny because I really didn't start out to make a UFO film or to really make a full-length version documentary film about Travis. I toyed with the idea, but I wasn't quite sure that I had it in me and that I had the budget or the finances to do it. But I met Travis being introduced by a mutual friend of ours, Bob, actually,
yeah.
Peter Robbins.
Uncle Peter.
Peter and I were, I was assisting Peter when he was running one of the Roswell conferences in Roswell, New Mexico in 2010, and he invited Travis to have dinner with us, and I was thrilled because I, of course, always heard about the Travis Walton story, but I had never met Travis directly. So in 2010, we had dinner together, and we started to talk about the fact that the Roswell conference draws over 10,000 people to the town of Roswell every year. And it's become a major economic boom for that city. And most of the people there are grateful to talk, share, acknowledge the Roswell story. And it's just become a very important conference. So we were having dinner with Travis saying, you know, Travis, your story is just as important as the Roswell story.
Yeah, for sure.
Have you ever considered doing a conference around your story somewhere in northern Arizona? And he had, but of course, running a conference is a lot different than being invited to speak at a conference. It can be daunting putting a conference together. And Peter and I had a lot of experience doing that. I myself, professionally, because I was an event coordinator for 15, 18 years, and I'd done weddings, bar and bat mitzvahs, conferences, you know, all sorts of things, you name it. And Peter knew that about me. And Peter also had been a consultant on a lot of conferences like McMinnville and Roswell and Exeter and the Experiencer Speak Conference up in Maine, as well as a number of other conferences over the last, 20 years that he's been on the speaking circuit. So he said, how about Jen and I become like conference coaches, and we start meeting and talking and emailing with you about how to put it together. And there are certain logical steps. So one of the things Travis wanted to do, this does get back to the film, and I'll get there quickly. One of the things Travis wanted to do in hosting a conference is to be able to take people back to the actual site where his abduction took place, which was up in the Sitgraves National Forest. It's a plateau that's about 7,000 feet high. It's the largest ponderosa pine forest in the world. And in November, it could be snowing up there, which actually it did this year at the conference. So if the weather is treacherous, it makes the roads impassable, and taking a group up there that have paid and registered and are happy and excited to go into the forest but actually can't just because of the mud and the difficulty in getting there, we decided we would do a virtual film of the site. Well, or actually not even a virtual film, but like a tour of the site with some of the guys involved from the crew. And in the event that we couldn't take people there, we had a backup in case we sold tickets for $30, $40, or $50 a piece to, hike people up into the forest, we would have a film we could show them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. I started out as a conference coach organizing a shoot to create a film, and my co-producer who did the film with me, named Bob Terrio here in Philadelphia, he actually edited that whole piece together himself, and it's called Tracking Skyfire, and it's a recount of that day, that famous historic day of November 5th, 1975, where the boys were picked up, where they lived, had the route they took to get up to the forest, what happened at what time, and, sort of the pursuit that took place for 5 days following that, looking for Travis. It doesn't really go into depth about the polygraph and other things like that, but it's just a short, concise, hour-long, intense documentary on that topic alone. And
wait a second. Was this the one that we see?
One that you saw was a more elaborate production.
I see.
So Bob and I finished Tracking Skyfire, and Bob did like 99.9% of the work. I did the shooting with him, and I organized the trip out there and, covered all of our expenses and everything to get that done. And we did it in time for a conference that never happened in 2013, but we were hoping it would. We were advising Travis to do conferences every year for 3, 4, or 5 years to build up to the 40th anniversary event so that he would get experience coordinating a conference, or that he would build a crew of people around him who would be able to manage the conference. And people who were on site, because I live in Philadelphia, Peter lives in Ithaca, New York, we weren't on site to run around and hang posters. So he was going to need a crew of people to help him get the conference up and running. But I thought if we had a film, in the event that we couldn't take people to the actual site, that would help. And then when we finished that in 2013, I realized that I could actually add some in-depth interviews with some of the crew people and maybe the polygraph a specialist, if he was still alive, some of the police officers at the time, if they were still alive, and possibly some other crew or family members, and really turn it into a really in-depth documentary following Travis's book.
Well, you sure did do that.
Thank you.
I
pushed to get it done almost a year in advance of the 40th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So that the film could serve as a promotional platform to bring people out to Heber for this conference, which just happened. We just had the 40th anniversary this past November 5th. It was 40 years to the day, and we had a great conference. And we did show the film there at this conference as well.
Was Peter there this time?
What was who?
Was Peter Robbins there this
time? Peter was there.
He was.
Peter came out. Yep.
God
yep.
bless
Peter
his
was there.
Soul.
The original crew of counselors and coaches were there. We, a group of us attend UFO conferences regularly. So whenever we found ourselves at a UFO event, like we often did in Arizona at the International UFO Congress, we would meet for breakfast for years and try to plan this this conference. And many of the people who were there at those breakfast meetings were all there at the conference, and many of the original crew members as well. Those that are living, most of them were there. There was only one that couldn't make it. That was Steve Pierce. But all the other guys came, and also Kenny Peterson. He was supposed to be there, but a family emergency called him away. So,
how fortunate, and how fortunate for you to have done that hour piece before.
Yes.
Because plenty of times it's when you're the first thing you do that really opens up in yourself and externally as well, just how much you can really accomplish or not accomplish. It's like getting there and getting it started. And I think that really made a difference. This is especially good film, especially in when we get a chance to talk about one of the greatest things you guys did. You exposed some individuals who are debunkers that have been needed, that research should have been done on these guys for such a long time. And I think you know who I'm talking about, right? Yes. Okay. Time out here on the playing field. Our guest is Jennifer Stein. Travis Walton will join us next hour, executive producer and director of Travis, a 90-minute documentary film recounting the famous 1975 UFO abduction of Travis Walton, and he'll be joined later on by him.
I'm Zechariah Sitchin. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Well, I'm always happy to be on your show and on Zoe's show, because it makes a lot of difference when the interviewer is knowledgeable and intelligent.
That's right. There's rules and regulations on 21st Century Radio is that we do read all of our books. And so some of these books, when you got to read them, and they're 500, 600, up to 800 pages, that's pretty tough to do. But we do it because we like to learn. Our guest is Jennifer Stein, executive producer and director of Travis, a 90-minute documentary film recounting the famous 1975 UFO abduction of Travis Walton. Oh, gosh, you know, Peter was with us. He was our tour guide to the Statue of Liberty. Last year, we came home last year about 2 days ago. This is quite a whole series of synchronicities. This is quite interesting when things like this happen, as far as I'm concerned. You've seen him just yesterday or so?
Travis?
Yeah.
Last week. I got home, on the 15th. I had also gone to the Lachlan UFO conference. That was done in Lachlan, Nevada, November 14th and 15th, and I showed the film there. So I was only, I was with Travis at that conference, so I think I came home Monday the 16th.
Well, I was actually talking about Peter Robbins.
Oh, Peter.
Uncle
yes,
Peter.
Yes, Peter was there, too, at the 40th anniversary conference in Phoenix with Travis and I and a group of other people, and I think he went off and did some other traveling as well before he came back to Ithaca.
Well, that sounds like Peter, all right. It really does. How has this film been received by audiences?
Very well, Bob. I have been so pleased. Almost immediately, I was getting phone calls from the International UFO Congress, of people who had been at the Congress, picked up the film, and returned home with it. Some people from Canada, people from Australia, England, even South America, Hawaii. People were calling me to arrange screenings, as well as a number of MUFON groups around the country. They were also calling me because because I'm a member of MUFON. So people immediately asked if they could screen it and show it, and I've done a lot of Skype and calls with different groups after the film was shown if I couldn't be there in person. So I have been very, very pleased with the turnout that and the response from the film. You know, people tend to think that the Fire in the Sky film that was done by Paramount in 1993 was telling the true story. And it's really not the true story of what happened to Travis. It's close to the story, but it's a fictionalized version of the story. Mm-hmm. Not all the characters were particularly the same in that film, and the actual events that happened on board the craft were very different. So the audience who sees this film is really very grateful to actually get the facts clear and straight. I think it helps not to muddy the water, especially when you're dealing with a phenomenon that's as out of the box as this mm-hmm. one.
Sure.
You really want to have the story straight. And Travis's story is really significant and unique for many reasons. And I think that's what attracted me to wanting to really document and archive this for future generations, because who knows if we're going to have books in another 60 years, right?
Yeah, that's a very sad problem. And I'm so glad you're involved in making sure that people spend some time reading, because it's with the younger people, it's a serious problem.
Yes, the younger generation gets their information in sound bites.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
they don't know history. And I think that the Travis Walton case is not only a significant UFO story, but it's a significant story for beginning to open people's minds and shift their consciousnesses about the reality of whether or not we're alone in the universe. And there's a good chance we're not.
Oh, I don't think there's a chance in any in the world that we're this. I mean, I think it's overwhelming. But, you know, but your film does more than even that. Do you know why? Yes, you'd probably know why.
I'll tell you why.
Because, you see, you know, we've been doing shows for, well, I've been involved in doing shows over 40-some years, but one of the biggest questions that all of us had, especially that back there in the 70s, 80s, and then in the 90s, was who in the world was giving Phil Klass the money to do the kind of things that he was doing?
You guys
hit it right on the head, and you did it so well. And no UFO researcher should, there's not a single UFO researcher that should not, well, let's put it this way, all of them have to see this film, because all of us had our suspicions. But the kind of research you did proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that Phil Klass was involved in some ways with the FBI and others, and he was a debunker that was actually paying other people to debunk. None of us could figure this out.
I spent a lot of time reading his files in Philadelphia. It's very interesting to me that his files are archived along with the gentleman who was responsible for the Condon report.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Robert Condon.
Yeah.
And also the former head of astronomy from Harvard University.
That's Don Menzel.
He was a big debunker for a long time. His name was
Don Menzel.
Howard Menzel.
Yeah.
So, and he was like the well-known debunker before Philip Klass was around.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting that their documents are archived in the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, but so are Philip Klass's.
Yeah.
And it takes an awful lot of money and time and energy, and, you know, you have to be really considered someone very significant and important for 20th century thinking to have your material archived in a place like this. I mean, my gosh, they've got Thomas Jefferson's, right, and Ben Franklin's, and, you know, a lot of other very significant people from history. But why is Philip Klass considered an important person from history? It's not like he was you know, the head of an astronomy department at a university. He was just a writer from Air and Space Magazine, you know, or Aviation Weekly. So why? I think it's quite clear that there is a desire to archive the debunking that he deliberately did on this topic so that people researching famous UFO stories would come across it and still consider the, you know, a bunch of these stories bogus. But, of course, in Travis's case, the more you read and the more you dig, the more you realize how insane his arguments were and how he took things out of context. He twisted words around. He deliberately repeated things in shorter sentences, dropping out very critical parts of conversations.
Yes,
that the meaning was changed in many cases. And he did this to certainly everyone involved in the Travis case. I mean, he didn't reach out to Travis, which was interesting. I guess because Travis was a little untouchable, and Philip's idea was that Mike Rogers had come up with this cockamamie idea of getting out of a forestry contract and still getting paid and therefore ripping off the federal government because the Forestry Service is part of the federal government. So he, it went as far as a federal investigator being hired to come up with several indictments against Mike Rogers, which all could not be proven. And therefore, they had to be completely dropped. He even said that Mike had come up with a fictitious person whom was really a member of his family, who I think worked for the Forestry Service. And this federal investigator showed up at a family reunion attempting to arrest Mike, and he couldn't because none of the counts of indictment were true. And that really frustrated Philip Klass to no end.
Well, I'm glad it did, because he has done so much damage.
Yes.
So much, because the media, you know, the media is who is ever in control of it. It doesn't necessarily mean you're getting any facts off of anything, but the media uses shortcuts, and they would always go to Phil Klass, and he would forever debunk just about any UFO story. But and with Phil, with this particular case here with Travis, he was trying to locate, I don't know how many people you have discussed in the book, of giving them $10,000. He would go to them and say, "We will give you this $10,000 if you will debunk
this case."
And no, he could get no one.
Right.
He could get no one.
He actually particularly targeted the youngest member of the crew named Steve Pierce, because he thought that the youngest one needed the money and might actually take it and then sort of go into hiding.
Mm-hmm.
Steve was harassed quite a bit, as all the men were on this story. Steve actually moved out of town. He moved to Texas, and he started using his middle name, Jeff, instead of his first name, Steve. And Philip chased him down, actually flew out to Texas, took him out to dinner, and tried to convince him to say that this wasn't true. And what's very interesting is that it's not really clear how Philip would have proved that it wasn't true, because Steve had already passed a lie detection test,
mm-hmm.
stating that it was in fact true that they had seen a UFO and that Travis had been hit by it and he had gone missing. So exactly how was Philip going to prove that this was a lie? I mean, that was still part of the required, I'm assuming, the required contract, but we don't actually know. And Travis actually thinks that maybe Philip knew that Steve was, you know, couldn't, you know, retract the lie detection test, and it was probably a promise that Phil was never going to have to pay, but maybe he could trick Steve into some sort of a statement and then never fulfill on the payment. So
yeah,
it's really not clear. But what's also very interesting is there was a local sheriff in Holbrook that delivered, it was either Holbrook or Snowflake, that actually delivered this written bribe. It was sent via, I think, Western Union. skin or something. So there is actually documentation that this was a true bribe that was delivered. Whether or not he called the police department and asked one of the sheriffs to deliver it, I think his name was Click or Flick or Flack Flake or something like that. One of the local police officers actually went to Steve Pierce's house, tracked him down through his mother, and then delivered the bribe to Steve.
Well, you know, the entire group, of course, including Travis, took many lie detector tests.
Yes,
How many did they fail?
They didn't fail any of them. There was one guy that had an inconclusive because he got all flustered and he didn't finish the test and he walked out. And I think that was Alan Dallas.
Yeah, that was in the very beginning, though.
That was in the very beginning. That's when Travis was still missing. And these boys were essentially being accused of murder.
That's right. Yeah.
And they were afraid that if they, by taking this test, that would be they would be tricked somehow into admitting a murder that they didn't do, and they would be arrested and thrown in jail and possibly tried for murder and maybe even spent the rest of their lives in prison if Travis didn't come back. I mean, there were a lot of unknowns going on. It's probably why this case made international news, because it was immediately a homicide story, a UFO story, and a missing person story. You know, and bizarre at that. So once it was out of the box, the story was out of the box, right? You couldn't, like, pack it back into some neat little story of some, you know, misidentified missing person or some object or something that was misidentified. There were over 500 people looking for Travis in the woods. I mean, everybody knew about this in northern Arizona.
And the film does this so well. You get to see how much damage to all of the people that were involved in it had when they had to face. And of course, they didn't necessarily. There were times when they weren't too happy with Travis. Is that correct?
Correct. I mean, Travis wasn't the only one getting ridiculed.
Yeah.
Everyone in the town was getting ridiculed, especially the people involved in the case.
We have a timeout here on the playing field on 21st Century Radio. As a matter of fact, yes, our guest is Jennifer Stein. She's the executive producer and director of Travis, a 90-minute film documentary recounting the famous 1975 UFO abduction of Travis Walton, which you will join us next hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
This is Bud Hopkins, UFO investigator, writer, and artist, and you're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus, 21st Century Radio, and I'm very pleased to be a guest here.
How did the abduction experience affect your relationships in the community?
Well, people reacted very negatively. You know, people were just desperate, grasping at straws, looking for any sort of an alternative explanation, and, you know, efforts got pretty wild there. They were trying to claim that I had a drug hallucination and just imagined this thing to happen, or that I'd had a transitory psychosis and suddenly, you know, just temporarily gone insane. But, you know, what people couldn't explain with those kind of theories is how do seven people have an identical hallucination?
Well, that really got them. How do they? They can't. Oh, that was a segment from Dr. Queen Zahara's interview with Travis back there in 1993 on, let's see, that was the 5th of November? March, oh, sorry. Fire in the Sky, that's when it was called then. Yes, indeed, and I was a bit disappointed in that particular film. I'm sure Travis was, too, and I bet you were, too, weren't you? Hello, Jennifer?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure if you were talking to me or Laura. Right here.
Oh. Well, I just thought that you probably were a little bit disappointed in the Fire in the Sky film.
Well, I, at the time when I first saw it, it was the best thing that was out there. And I think it brought a lot of people's attention to this interesting story. Mm-hmm. But since it changed the facts, it really led people astray as well.
Yeah.
And I think it painted not really the correct light on the whole topic, because if you know the true story, it really begins to open your consciousness, and you want to read and learn more, and you're fascinated by this amazing event.
Mm-hmm. How did you get the archived footage?
Well, I worked with Stanton Friedman, and if you remember, Stanton says in the documentary, he says, I was hired to be a co-script writer and a consultant on a documentary film about the UFO topic, and this was done in 1978. So it was through Stanton that I contacted the producer he worked with, and he was still alive. His name was Brandon Chase, and he lives in California. So I called the Chases up. Their phone still worked, and I convinced them to let me use the footage in the Travis Walton film for the 40th anniversary event that we were doing. And that's how I came across it.
Well, Stanton Friedman has been a real pillar in the research community in this area. He's one of the great leaders.
Yes, he is.
I hope he lives another 50 years or so.
From your mouth to God's ears. Me too.
Yeah, great man. Did you have any challenges while filming?
Yes, we did. There were all sorts of, there's always issues that come up. You know, you always have mic issues and whatnot. The location up in the forest was quite difficult to get to, especially with a lot of equipment, because you had to hike in there, and it's about maybe, I don't know, a quarter of a mile hike from the nearest road, from the Rim Road. So we eventually, Travis and I, making so many trips back and forth to the car and up to the site and back and forth, that we finally decided we'd, clear a path. So we spent a half a day moving boulders and chopping down small trees in order to drive closer into the site so we didn't have to schlep so much equipment. I was convinced we were going to actually destroy the rental car I had arranged to get. But we didn't, and that was a challenge. We also used, we had a wonderful camera assistant who came up from the Gilbert area in Arizona that Travis had found. His name is Gary Hilton, and he flies a helicopter drone. It's a small little camera mounted on this cute little drone that lifts up into the air, and we lost one of those in the forest. So Travis and I actually had to spend a day finding it, and we were, worried we were going to be lost, run out of water, run out of cell phone power, and not really know where we were, because we had to hike into a part of the forest that was sort of, off the beaten track, so to say. We wanted to capture this beautiful rim that is, that you hear described so beautifully. We wanted to capture this plateau. So we took a risky move, and we decided to fly a drone off a very rocky, steep cliff in 60-foot ponderosa pine trees. And sure enough, the drone was challenged by the wind gusts that were up there, and it tipped it sideways. It lost power, and it dropped into this forest. And it's about a $2,000 piece of equipment, so... We decided we had to go looking for it, and there was no, organized path to get there, so to speak, and it was, that was a little challenging.
How did you get, is that how you got the aerial shots above the forest floor?
Yes, that's how we got it.
Yeah, it's really impressive filmmaking.
Yes.
Really, it is.
Yes.
Again, great camera people and a drone. Boy, I didn't know how... and you didn't have that much experience with drones yourself, right?
I didn't know how to fly them at all, and you actually are not allowed to fly them unless you are an experienced pilot and you have a pilot's license, because they don't want these running into airplanes. And if you could send it 5 miles up, and literally it could fly into a prop plane or into an engine of a jet or something, and cause that plane to crash. So you have to know what you're doing with these. Easy feat.
Wow.
And I was very, very, very grateful that Gary was interested in our project and came up and helped us with it.
Now, before we go into next hour, are you going to be with us a little bit next hour?
Yes, I am. I'm going to be standing by. I understand you'll be with Travis, and if there's a problem with his phone or anything like that, I'll be here.
Good going. Now, why, again, I'm going to repeat this. We touched on it in the beginning. Why has Travis's case remained one of the most famous cases of UFO abduction on record?
Well, there aren't too many cases where there are seven people that observe a craft, that there's a direct encounter where someone goes missing, and someone's missing 5 days, and all the crew members who were on this crew took lie detector tests, and eventually all passed these lie detection tests, and the whole town was involved in hunting for him. So the number of people involved in this case is huge from the get-go. And, you know, again, lie detection is something that's quite expensive to
have done.
So for them to have taken multiple lie detection tests or polygraph tests, it's almost unheard of in a UFO case. So it brings more validity to the story. And then when you start to explore what Travis actually experienced, encountering more than one type of species, and seeing more than one type of craft and being in some sort of aircraft hangar maybe or underground bunker or mothership somewhere up in the air. I mean, we don't know where he was, but his descriptions are fascinating. And he also did not have the typical type of abduction as was portrayed in the Fire in the Sky film. It wasn't a abduction in the case where, you know, he's knocked out. Well, I guess he was knocked out, but it wasn't like he was taken while he was asleep or he was paralyzed. When Travis woke up on that table, he had full control of his abilities, although he was in a weakened state. But he had full memories of what happened to him. Nothing about his memories were suppressed or needed the actual regression to come forward. He was only regressed because of the post-traumatic stress he was experiencing. So his case is very unique. And in one other thing I like to point out to people is that Travis never had a choice to come forward or not, which is what a lot of people do, you know, think a lot about. If they say they get a regression, they realize they've had an abduction experience or they have missing time, nobody knows about it, so they can keep it quiet if they don't want to come forward with it. But Travis never had a choice. He was famous while he was missing because it broke as a homicide story and as a missing person story and a UFO story. So by the time he came back, there had been hundreds of people who had been looking for him for 5 days in the woods. So there was no putting it back in Pandora's box.
And it must have been so hard for the others because they were being charged, many people, especially even members in their family. Certainly people in the town thought that that they indeed may have murdered Travis.
That's right.
And they were all very close to him. I mean, you know, that's what is so ironic about this, because they were a real team. This was a team that worked hard for years together. Lifetime friendships and things of that nature. So it was it's quite different than most any other case that I've ever seen or read about. But I got to tell you, again, what you accomplished by setting the record straight in regards to especially the debunking is much more important than I think, well, most people would first understand, because, you know, I'm sure you were conscious as to what was going on back there in the 70s, 80s, and 90s with debunking. And especially a broadcaster like ourselves, we were forever attacked by doing any shows on UFOs and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I think what it did for that particular crew is that they really bonded in such a way that they became much stronger. But boy, they still had a lot of pain to go through. It takes an awful lot to be put down time in and time again. I'm an artist. You're an artist. You know how it is. You're always going to be criticized no matter what, right?
Right. Right.
There's no way in the world you're going to please over 30 or 40% of the people, especially when you're doing work that happens to have any importance history to it. So what would you like to leave with us before we go into next hour and brother Travis is going to join us?
Well, I would just say to your listening audience, you're in for a treat. You're going to get to talk to the man himself.
Now, this guy obviously really knows himself. You know that old phrase, man, know thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. Remember that one? As above, so below.
Yes.
He has been through the worst of things, and now I can't say he's going to be going through the best of things, but it's a heck of a lot better than it used to be. And we'll be back with our guest Jennifer Stein and, of course, Travis Walton in just 5 or 6 minutes.
With stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lissandra. 22 raids conducted in Brussels and southern Belgium. 16.